The following podcast contains explicit language.
You're listening to Working, the show about what people do all day. I'm your host, Jordan Weissman, and I just want to start off this week by thanking everybody who wrote in to tell me whether or not they wanted to hear an interview with the in-house economist at Wizards of the Coast. The overwhelming answer, in fact, the unanimous answer was yes. Everybody who wrote in told me that they absolutely want to geek out on more Magic the Gathering and hear from the economist who does the math that most mere mortals cannot even conceive of, as Mark Rosewater put it. I am working on that interview, and I promise you at some point we will get it in the can. But in the meantime, what do I have on tap for you this week? This episode is going to be about what it's like to start your own think tank. I think that when most people hear that phrase, think tank, they imagine some stodgy institution in Washington, D.C. But there's been this really interesting movement over the last few years where young activists and policy wonks have been founding their own institutions the way someone might have, you know, founded a tech startup or, you know, started a band. They are starting policy shops to kind of press for more progressive change in this country. And one of those is a group called Data for Progress, which was co-founded by Sean McAuley. You might know Sean as a guest on The Gist, Mike Pesca's daily show here at Slate. You might also know him as the guy who popularized the phrase abolish ICE, which obviously dominated a lot of conversation about immigration for a good long while. But his group, Data for Progress, has become really well known, even though it's still young, it's still small, as an organization that does polling on progressive policy ideas. It figures out if people really like the idea of forgiving student debt or reparations. It also puts out a lot of its own policy proposals. It produced its own interesting version of the Green New Deal before that was on a lot of people's radars. And so I wanted to hear from him about what it takes to actually start one of these organizations. How the heck do you do it? And what do you actually do with your day besides tweet? Anyway, I thought it was a fun conversation. Hope you enjoy. What's your name and what do you do?
I'm Sean McAuley, and I'm a co-founder of Data for Progress, the leading progressive think tank in the United States.
All right, so Sean.
And possibly the world.
Quite possibly the world.
We are leading if you measure us in terms of retweets per tweet.
Is that your metric?
We scrape all of the tweets from all the think tanks. And yes, Center for American Progress does have a budget that is 100 times larger than us, but we do get more retweets per tweet than them.
It's like a baseball or a basketball efficiency rating kind of thing. Like, is that the...
If you were to have like think tanks above replacement, yeah. I welcome the saber metrics.
Have you ever gone to a donor and said, this is how many retweets we get?
Yeah, it's in our deck.
Oh my God. All right. So for listeners, you guys may have noticed that this doesn't sound like a typical working interview. I should give some background. Sean, when did we first get to know one another? I must have been back in like 2013 when you were pitching me stuff from Demos, right? Or 2014?
Yeah, when I was at Demos, I developed a sort of interesting way into sort of like the elite commentariat, which was I would harass you on Twitter, and then I would like pitch you on stories.
That actually was a pretty good... I was an editor back then. That worked pretty well. That was also what Matt Brunig did a little bit of.
Yeah, because there's this like liberal guilt where you're like, if I don't publish him, it'll seem like it's because like he's harassing me.
So,
and yeah, no, it worked. Like it worked. That's how I got into the New York Times too.
So now you run Data for Progress, which, I mean, boasting aside, is one of the major players in the think tank game.
I would say that. I mean,
yeah, in the progressive think tank game.
Yeah. But I mean, I think like the progressive think tank game is important on account of Democrats like occasionally do hold power. But what I'd say is like we are social media obsessed. Like here's a little working fact. I still run the Twitter account and I do not plan to like ever not run the Twitter account because it's so central to sort of how we are seen by the media, because you media people are the people who like determine American narratives and politics. And you've decided to spend 7 or 8 hours a day like glued to Twitter. And so like if you're a think tank and you're like shopping it off to like a social media intern, right? Like you are shopping off the central mechanism through which Matt Iglesias will like interact with your ideas.
Yeah.
So I'm obsessed with the social, and like one of the things that I love to go through is like the Day of Progress feed, and you'll see like people really engage with our content organically. Like you go to another think tank and you'll see like one retweet. With us, it's like our sort of meaty content has, you know, 50, 60, 70. Some of our reports have 200 retweets. And then our memes have, you know, thousands sometimes, because like this is the central way through which people will see us. And like, I'm surprised that more people haven't done it. Like I'm obsessed with like Twitter cards. Like one afternoon, I was just like, oh, our Twitter cards look ugly. And like, I figured out how to do like pretty Twitter cards. And then like, I did a style guide.
What is it?
Like,
what is a Twitter card for?
So on Twitter, like the way that your tweets pop up.
Yeah.
So like we write in a set of code that we inject into all of our blogs. So it does the big Twitter card instead of the small Twitter card.
Yeah.
And then we make sure the pictures are like perfect. And then like the little write up. And like, I get really mad about that. I check all of our blogs before they go out. I like make sure like that I'm like comfortable with the subhead and stuff like that.
Okay. So this is getting to the question that I brought you in here for, because, you know, again, I'm part of the media and I talked to you about, you know, what you're doing at Data for Progress or what you guys are working on. But fundamentally, I have no fucking clue what you do with your time mostly. Like,
oh, yeah?
I'm just like, this is what I want to know is if you are running a think tank.
Sure.
What is your daily life? What is it? Apparently, it's a lot of trying to reach me on Twitter or trying to reach Matt Iglesias. But what is your life? What is your week?
Do you know the sort of story of Fidel Castro in the New York Times?
No.
There's this story, and apparently like a New York Times reporter goes to like hang out with Fidel and shit before the revolution. And he like, Fidel like sits the reporter in a cave and he like looks out and then like walks the same 100 troops by him, like
over and over again,
over and over again. And the New York Times reporter goes back to the United States and is like, Fidel has amassed an army.
I think I see where this is going.
And like, that's what media is in America.
So your job as a think tanker is to march that army past me over and over again.
Yeah.
Those 100 troops.
No, but more seriously, like there are some think tank presidents, I won't name names or whatever, but who are like always posting on Twitter. And like, I'm like genuinely like day to day, I'm like, how the fuck are you doing this? Cause like, I don't know, like if you follow my Twitter a lot, but, like I've like definitely not posted as much.
I mean,
running an organization requires an incredible amount of work.
It does. Well, so, I mean, yeah, you posted a lot during the abolish ICE days, right? When that was sort of your big thing. You were the popularizer of abolish ICE. And I've noticed you've sort of tailed off a little bit since then.
On Twitter, yeah. I mean, like this is sort of, it's always been my obsession. Like I think I've mentioned it like a Columbia Journalism Review piece, but like my view of left politics is eventually like we've got to like butter motherfuckers' breads and stuff. My dream, I've always been obsessed with like institutions, right? Like we have to build these institutions. And my dream is like to build an institution where like someone can come to the institution, like get a job there, like have a child, like do maternity or paternity leave and like come back and that institution exists. And like that's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's a lot of resources. It's an incredibly difficult task to build. And, you know, I've been invested in left politics for a long time and there's no really like handbook, right? Like Jacobin is a great magazine. They have like the journal, like the Catalyst Journal, but like the Catalyst Journal, like can't tell you like how to build an institution. And so, you know, when you start thinking about those types of questions, it becomes a very different game. And it turns out it's something like I'm decently skilled at and I really enjoy doing. I really enjoy building an institution. And like, I try to the extent possible to, you know, get back into the data.
So how did you even get involved in the think tank world to begin with? Like, where was your start in that? What's like your creation story?
Yeah. Well, I was a chubby kid, which I assume is obvious on account of I'm a chubby adult. And so I wasn't like that good at sports, but I was like decent at like debating. And I did like debate all throughout like high school and through much of college. And I sort of was always interested, like, what if we, like, what if I was, like, debating as, like, a job? And, like, so I heard of think tanks, and I was like, oh, that sounds like debating as a job. Like, that's very interesting to me.
Was that in college?
Yeah. And yeah. So I did a variety of internships. I'm sure people who dislike me are aware that I at one point was at the Reason Institute. I wasn't like a...
Which is for listeners who don't keep track of all this. That's libertarian.
Yeah, it's libertarian. I mean, I grew up in a pretty evangelical family. I wasn't like an Ayn Rand libertarian. I was like, as a young person, I read like Thomas Sowell's book.
Okay.
And like libertarian thinking is very appealing because it's a very simple set of beliefs that you can like hold. And there, it's very easy to hold those beliefs until they come into the reality of like the world. And so like-
Which means college is a good time for it.
Yeah. I mean, I had friends who, you know, in my social circle from high school who like didn't end up going to college. And it wasn't like through their fault of their own. It was like, you know, some of my friends like had family members who were, you know, addicted to drugs and like had to basically raise their own siblings and stuff. And it's like, when you see that, it's like, huh, that's really hard to like square with like a libertarian theory of the case. And so, you know, definitely began to move in a more progressive direction. After that, I was sort of like, I did a big like senior thesis in college on inequality and opportunity and how those are related. And it's been a set of work that's been very interesting to me throughout my career. And in doing that type of work, I sort of moved to a more like very class focused school of like left thought. And then I was really lucky. And like to this day, I can't really explain how this happened, but I got a internship at Demos, which is a progressive think tank in New York. And it was really, I mean, amazing opportunity. And Demos was just transitioning president. So Heather McGee became the president. And she really was sort of focused on Demos moving past, well, I wouldn't say moving past, like sort of taking the sort of labor left roots of the organization that was really centered in like a union inequality style of thinking and towards like a sort of racial equity understanding of progressive politics. And so like I sort of like really was schooled in that tradition, and it sort of ended up being very prescient how Demos sort of adopted that style of thinking as the 2016 election unfolded.
What made you then strike out on your own?
I think like there was this sense for me that there was this new generation of progressive thought and that we had something to say and we didn't yet have institutions to say it and who were like accountable to young people and who were invested in the sort of like next generation of politics, right? Like, so a lot of the organizations we work with are like groups like Indivisible, Justice Democrats, you know, Working Families Party now has a very young president, right? You know, Justice Democrats, the president there, Alex Rojas, is, I believe, 26 or 27. Ocasio-Cortez is, you know, 29. Like, so there was just like this sense, like, we definitely need a new set of institutions now.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
When did you officially start Data for Progress?
Oh, God. It started as just like a name.
Yeah.
This is the dirtiest secret. The name's really great, right? Like, I feel like people just like damn, Day for Progress, what a great name. Someone once thought we were an arm of the Center for American Progress, which was kind of funny.
That's not a crazy leap.
Yeah. I wanted to like name it the Greek word for data. Colin was like, Sean, there are like 3,000 data consultancies that have that name.
Colin
McAuliffe. Yeah,
partner. So you guys were sitting around saying, let's start a think tank. I mean, like, is this like a DIY band kind of like?
It was
like,
yeah,
take me inside, like how you guys said it's time for think tank. And when was this exactly? Like, it's time to
it, yeah, yeah. So the basic, I think, way that's best to understand it coming out is like, I became very interested in a statistical technique called multi-level regression and post-stratification, MRP. And the interesting thing about MRP was that it allows you to take national level survey results and create estimates at the state level by basically forming a hierarchical model that includes the geographic predictors and the individual level predictors. And if you'll recall, in 2016, Democrats won nationally, but did not win because of the Electoral College. And polling didn't really do a good job of telling us that. And so I became very interested in like techniques that did a better job of like disaggregating geographies. Mm-hmm. And multi-level regression and post-stratification is still something Data for Progress is constantly thinking about, working on, improving. I also had a sense that when I was at Demos, I did a lot of like survey research using like the American National Election Studies, Cooperative Congressional Election Studies, etc., etc. And I became very frustrated because a lot of the questions that I am very interested in as a leftist and a socialist are not asked on American public opinion surveys. So I was like, wow, it would be very good to like own and control the means of survey production. So Colin reached out to me and he was like, hey, I can do MRP. And I did not meet Colin for months until after we started. And we started working on building this MRP model. And we started to get it, you know, sort of early versions of it in early 2018.
And you were building that model before you had a think tank. This was you guys just working together on a model.
And so what we basically did was we would go around to organizations who had done survey research and we would say, can you give us the micro data so we can fit the model on it?
Yeah.
And we started fitting the model. And then I reached out to John Green, who was a fellow like online shit poster, who sort of quit the game and went to Ohio State. And so the first thing we ever did was we took Kaiser Family Foundation data on Medicare for All, and we fit a multi-level regression. And then we took Cooperative Congressional Election Studies data on Medicaid expansion.
Yeah.
And we did a piece for Mike.com on like Medicaid expansion was popular. And to do that, like we like came up with this name and everything was done by email now. And we now have like a Slack that costs me like $5,000 a year. But everything was done by email and we invented a name. And then we like literally like bought the domain and just like threw up Data for Progress. And we initially did dataforprogress.com and it's now dataforprogress.org. And I think like dataforprogress.com, I think it just like redirects to dataforprogress.org. But yeah, so that was the beginning. And then the first 3 months was just like, how do we convince someone to get us enough money to like actually start running a survey? And, you know, we ended up, I had a lot of friends in the progressive spaces. And so like, I sort of was like, hey, you know, like, what if we field the survey? And they were like, oh, you know, you're probably going to want to use like a sort of established vendor. You can cut out all the analysis costs, but you need to get it from a reputable panel because people won't believe you. So we used YouGov.
Yeah.
And the first poll we actually did, and like, there's a reason like I run the operations now is because I don't think John and Colin can assume this sort of risk just emotionally and mentally. We commissioned our first poll before we had money to pay for it. And I figured we would just eventually get the money and then we would pay for the poll.
What's the worst? You've got a nonprofit. Created a nonprofit?
No, at that point we were just like an LLC.
But you had limited liability at that point.
Yeah,
at least.
We were an LLC.
So it's okay if you go bankrupt, it's fine. You had no money to begin with.
And so yeah, we started an LLC and yeah, we did the first poll and it was like, I don't know, like, you know, old school, that would be dumb, but like new school, like that's what MoviePass did.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, let's maybe that's not the comparison sure. you want to draw. But so you guys were faking it till you made it, basically. I mean, it was a startup model, but in this case, it's a think tank instead of, you know, an app.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It was very much like, and to this day, like, you know, we have like fellows and like, I'm sort of like, just imagine me as like creating a think tank, but like with all of the trappings in a normal think tank, but like, I just like, I treat it, I don't know, like every think tank's fellows program is just like friends of the person who runs it, right? So like, that's what our fellows program is, but they're younger yeah. and cool and like have fresh ideas.
Well, that's also what's smart about that is if you have someone whose ideas you like, but they have no institutional affiliation, you can automatically give them more cred with the press by just saying they're a fellow at this think tank.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's kind of the game there.
Yeah, exactly. Like we've had some like really cool papers that came out just because like we were the only people who would publish them. There's like a guy named Max Casey who did this amazing paper on the EITC. And I'd always like sort of jokingly like had this joke where like the way you get UBI is you call it EITCX. And then he like actually wrote the paper for us. And so like it's on the site. But like, yeah, we were able to just like suck up like tons and tons of interest. And like folks really wanted to do work and like, you know, publish these papers with us. And so it's like, you know, the slow boring of hard bores.
Well, it also seems like there was like a hole in the market, right? Like you had more progressive, more left-wing policy talent, academic talent out there than there were institutions willing to publish that. Like you had the Roosevelt Institute and CAP was sort of, Center for American Progress is considered a little bit more moderate and more DC establishment focused. So you guys were sucking up that free talent.
Yeah, yeah, exactly that. And there's another thing that was just like sort of necessitated by the way the organization came together, which is like if you're normally building an institution, like you make a deck and then you go to like rich people and you're like, hey, rich people, like you should make this happen. Whereas with us, we're sort of like I don't know a lot of rich people. And so what we had to do was we had to build the thing and then go to rich people and be like, hey, this is a pretty cool thing we built, right? Like you should make sure we keep the lights on. And we've always seen it that way. And to this day, like people who advise us on fundraising are sort of confused because we almost have like an investment model where I invest some of the stuff we do for, we get resources to do sets of work. And then I invest some of that into a new set of work I want to do and then like build up that set of work and then say like, hey, you should like fund this to go further because I don't like the idea of like rich people telling me what to do.
Yeah. That's a constant problem with think tanks, right?
Yeah, it's
like
yeah.
They have their pet project that they will fund. And that's a way around that.
Like we started this, this is just a crazy set of data work, like compiling tons and tons of election results because we built like an ecological inference model that runs off the voter file to basically create exit polls based on precinct level results. So the model basically scores individuals within the precinct on a 0 to 100 scale. And then you can use that to like basically create a sort of sense of how people voted. And so we started building this. And the reason we actually built it was entirely for me to win online debates that I had about suburban voters' political views. Cause I was like, well, we know it in surveys, yeah. But I guess like to prove it, like we would have to like actually do ballot initiative studies.
So, I love it. Like a Twitter spat actually leads to straight up think tank work for you guys.
Oh yeah. Like we spent many thousands of dollars like litigating my feuds. And so we sort of like looked around and we couldn't find it. So I was just like, I built it. And then I emailed one of our friends at the tank and I was like, hey, we're going to do this. And they said, like, do you have funding for it? And I said, like, if I asked rich people for permission before we did everything, like, where would we be? And so, like, that's a interesting new way to do things because I do think that organizations, you know, there's a sort of left critique of, like, the donor relationship as sort of having like an ideological valence.
Yeah.
And my actual view on this is mostly that it has a small C conservative valence, which is that people feel afraid to try new things because you want to stick to like the tried and true. And what I think a lot about is like, how do we solve very specific problems that organizations are facing and sort of like build that capacity for them and then sort of like build it and then say like, look what we've done.
Cue, fund more of this.
Exactly.
I want to come back to the donors in a minute, but at this point, how many people actually work for Data for Progress? Like, are employees thereof?
We mostly have contractors who,
yeah,
and it's like mostly people who are in tenure at a university or on staff at a university who, for our policy stuff, we have them do like a like report or a brief,
yeah,
on an issue that means a lot to them. And what we do is we supplement it with polling, or
yeah,
we build a partnership with like a group like the Justice Collaborative, which has incredible work that they do, but they don't really have the sort of like ability to do polling on the work that they do, or wouldn't know how to do it if they wanted to. So they sort of come to us with the policies and we trust them.
Yeah.
And then we build upon that. But actually we have two employees now.
Is that including you and Colin?
No, Colin is actually not an employee.
Okay.
He has like a real job. He's,
yeah.
It's Julian Noisecat, who oversees all of our Green New Deal,
yeah,
strategy. And then Brittany Bennett, who oversees our work on automatic voter registration,
mm-hmm,
and also works with us on grant making. And then we have an in-house like fellow who is Kate Aronoff. And then we have a wide range of other fellows. And then we have people who like do stuff on contract, but like have other gigs. I also have like other gigs because like,
yeah,
Data for Progress doesn't like pay a lot of salary. So, you,
yeah,
know, I like do take a small stipend, but I still have to do like other work to support myself, because like we really want to invest everything in building the organization. And I think it's worth noting, like people are sort of interested, like, you know, you would think Data for Progress would hire like a data scientist before someone like Julian.
Yeah.
But I took a really different approach to that. My view was, we're doing this work on the Green New Deal and we're doing like a lot of policy and survey work. But there's a famous quote, people don't know, care how much you know until they know how much you care. And so having someone like Julian who can actually build authentic relationships with organizations on the ground such that they trust our data, they want to hear more from us, is actually much more important right now than anything else we could be investing in building.
So, and so Julian's like, he's fundamentally an organizer. That's sort of.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone at Data for Progress has multiple hats.
Yeah.
That's just sort of my understanding of the startup world in the private sector is similar. The lots of hats type of situation. But yeah, I mean, Julian is an organizer. He's been on the ground for many of the pipeline protests, but he is also a strategist. He is also a very effective communicator, and he is actually an incredibly effective policy thinker as well. I think people sometimes don't think of activists and policy, but some of the smartest policy thinkers I've met have been activists, and I think that's true of Julian. I mean, he went on the weeds, and I think had a very good interview with Iglesias.
Yeah. I want to kind of like try to almost, you know, verbally diagram out what we're talking about with Data for Progress. When behind the name, behind the, you know, yeah, online presence, you've got an organization that is two main employees, they're kind of the organizing front of it. And there's you, you're kind of the head of it, but you're not taking a salary. It's your project. You've got Colin also, who sort of has a real job. And then you have this network of people doing papers and data analysis for you, and you're kind of funding all that freelance stuff to kind of keep the ideas flowing.
Yeah, it's like, and I do take a stipend.
Yeah.
And then we have, so we have the core, like most of the money is like for building out, like data is costly.
Yeah.
You're
paying pollsters to go out and do all that.
Well, yeah. So we have the voter file,
yeah,
and then we have polling, but we have a sort of non-traditional relationship with the pollsters in that like we ask to receive the raw data.
Yeah.
Right. The product that we are looking for is not like a set of like memos or a slide deck.
Yeah.
Right. I want the data that we can analyze and sort of like run regressions on and stuff like that. That's sort of a non-traditional relationship.
Yeah, and it costs less money on your end too, because yeah. They don't have to put the man hours in to do all that.
Yeah, yeah. And then we are increasingly, you know, like it's not incredibly hard to run your own survey. The big problem is like many people still sort of like don't like us and sort of discount our data for that. And I know that that's something that's true, which is why we're actually much faster in terms of putting raw data on the internet so that people can explore it. We're obsessed with that. Very few people do put the raw data up. We often put like the raw data up like so fast it's like bad for us, because like people will dig into our data and find like cool findings that like we could have found ourselves if we had not put it out so early. But we're really committed to that transparency, and we really do end up having to have a higher quality, you know, panel for the results we produce. There are lots of organizations that have more established names who use what is, in my opinion, lower quality panels, but they can do that because, you know, they're not seen as like scrappy. But, you know, we definitely have the capacity, and we sometimes do for internal purposes, field our own surveys on other panels. But
yeah,
at the end of the day, journalists like knowing that it was from a high quality panel, politicians who were trying to persuade to our view, like knowing it was from a high quality panel. And one of the funniest things is like people are always like, oh, Data for Progress like skews the results. And from my perspective, we actually make several decisions in-house that do not. For example, we have a somewhat support, neither support nor oppose, somewhat oppose, strongly oppose, not sure. If we were to get rid of the neither support or oppose or the don't know, we would end up with more progressive results, because the people who tend to choose the neither support nor oppose, disproportionately women, and women tend to have more liberal views. So if you could have those people instead choosing the progressive position, you would have a higher support for your policy. I mean, you can look at the way we word questions. I work really, really hard to word our questions in a fair way. We're doing a big Medicare for All project that's going to come out soon. And I spend an entire day basically calling up economists to try to figure out like specific payroll tax raises that would be necessary to fund Medicare for All, so that the question wording would actually reflect actual policy reality. You know, the work we've done with Civis, we've had like, we explicitly say Democrats are opposing this. We offer arguments for it and against it. And when things are expensive, I include taxes to pay for them, because the conservative movement, in my view, went off the rails because they created an alternative reality for themselves. And so we want to be in the reality as it exists.
And when you say a high quality panel,
right?
That means a high quality pollster. That means like YouGov, or what does that mean exactly?
Sure. So polling used to be done mostly on phones.
Yeah.
Right. Less and less is that true. So more and more people use online panels, which is like market research companies will create panels of people who are within the panel, and who then they can like sort of induce to take surveys for, you know, like Amazon gift cards or something like that. You know, Harvard has created their own online panel, small online panel. So, and those panels are tested. Pew has done studies of online panels to sort of see how balanced they are demographically, how well they're maintained. And a good panel vendor will be very obsessed with like making sure that their panel is well balanced, and they'll append a lot of variables to the individual respondents on the panel, which is very useful. So, you know, we do use the YouGov panel. We trust the Civics panel. I think Drew Linzer has done a lot of great work.
You go to the company, you go to Civis, you go to YouGov, and you say, here's our survey. These are the questions we want to ask. You guys conduct it. We're going to pay you to conduct it, and then you're getting the data back from them, and you're making what you will of it.
Yeah.
And that's, again, it's a little bit more DIY than a lot of other think tanks, I guess, because they're not necessarily, they're usually commissioning the report back or something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I will say that in some of our other projects, we actually have asked YouGov for help with the write-ups. And honestly, oftentimes it's a capacity issue. Mm-hmm. From our end, I have much less time than I can spend firing up a firing up the Stata. But yeah, that's exactly correct. And the other thing is like in a lot of instances, you'll want voter file matches. And
what's the voter file for?
Oh yeah, sure. So the modern political campaign is run off of voter file. The secretaries of states of all states maintain these voter files. You can purchase them. And increasingly on both the Republican and Democratic side, there are probably like 2 to 3 vendors that sort of take these voter files and are constantly purchasing from the secretaries of states, updating them, and then appending lots and lots of stuff to the voter files. So
like this person is black, middle class, et cetera, that kind of data, college educated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mostly through some sort of model, 0 to 100. You know, in some states, your race is on the voter file. In other states, it's not. In some cases, you'll have commercial data that you can get and append to the voter file. And in some cases, it is a probabilistic model based on your last name and the census block that you live in, and then as much other information as the vendor can gather about you. So yeah, so we will sometimes want the survey respondents match back the voter file so that we can use that to do modeling.
What's the best way to learn a language? Immersion, living where the language is spoken and using it every day in everyday situations. But if that's not on the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. I've used apps in the past to learn new languages, but when I came across Babbel, I wondered if it could help me refresh my knowledge of a language I once spoke well, but was now a little bit or quite a lot rusty. I have to say, I was impressed. The advanced lessons were really useful, tips and idioms that can help with in-depth conversations on topics that I can actually imagine chatting about. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations, and the tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. What's more, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time deal for working listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for working listeners, at babbel.com/working. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/working, spelled BABBEL.com/working. Rules and restrictions may apply.
All right, it's Monday.
Yeah.
What are you up to?
Oh, so...
What time do you get up?
I normally get up around like 9:30 or 10.
All right.
I work from home, so like I cut out that whole commute.
Yeah.
You know, like most people, they have a commute in the morning. I don't. I just like get up and I...
Fire up Twitter.
Fire up my computer. Ah, God, in the old days, more and more, it's...
yeah.
I got to get that email.
Oh, God.
I have a three computer screens. I think that's the only way that a human being should engage with the online.
Wait, so three?
Yeah.
What are they each for? I get two, but you have like the full like kind of banker setup? Is that the...
Yeah. Well, I have my laptop in the middle and then two screens on the other side. Normally one will be like email, one will be like Slack, and then one will be like Twitter or my calendar.
Yeah.
Because you know like... A lot of emails, a lot of phone calls.
Yeah.
I try to walk whenever I'm on the phone, pace a little bit, get some exercise in. But yeah, I wake up around 10 or 9 or 10, closer to 10 normally, and sometimes a little later than that. I try not to schedule any calls before 11. I try to keep Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday like relatively call-free, but normally still we'll have 4 or 5 calls that I'll have to hop on in those days. And then it's like really throughout the day, it's going to be a lot of Slack, a lot of email. So I am very meticulous about the surveys and the instruments. It ends up taking us a little longer to field sometimes just because I will constantly like go back and want to like tweak it and make sure it's good. We do bigger surveys. Bigger surveys are cheaper to run. Mm-hmm. So we try to put a lot of stuff on those, and online web panels have allowed for surveys to become a little bit lengthier. And so a very decent chunk of my time is going to be survey stuff. Very decent chunk of my time is going to be working on the media stuff, you know, reporters will have a lot of questions,
yeah,
stuff about our work. We aim to have one major release every week. This week, we'll have two. The first was we released a memo on pharmaceutical pricing and and sort of support for generic options and support for Medicare negotiating with pharmaceutical companies. And then there's a lot in terms of getting a sense of like building partnerships. You know, I make sure I read everything we put out before it goes out to, you know, just like make sure we are firmly within where the progressive movement is thinking on these sorts of issues. But yeah, it is a lot of management type stuff.
What is the single activity that takes up the biggest share of your week?
Oh, is it emailing?
Just email.
And phone calling.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been doing better at that, but like, you know, there was a time where it was just like, I would have so many phone calls. Like I would just take everything. It's really just like so much stuff comes up. Cause like I'm like very hands-on, obviously. I don't really want to not be hands-on though.
Yeah.
Either. But like, yeah, I mean like I do our tweets. I like check over all of our surveys. We have a memes consultant.
You have a memes consultant?
Yeah. I do in-house most of the memes.
Is it like a 17-year-old somewhere? Like, what was your memes consultant?
The memes consultant is like a very famous Twitter personality who also shoots. Like, I will like literally like hit them up and be like, hey, can I get some memes of like Nathan for You? I did the really recent though, Nathan for You one. That was really funny. I did that one. But yeah, like I'll like hit up the memes consultant. Yeah, like just making sure like everything is moving.
Yeah.
It's like that is so much work. It's just like making sure like we have like six or seven reports right now that are in the hopper, just slowly moving forward, making sure, you know, all of our stuff that comes out is, you know, firmly progressive. I make sure we're not canceled. I spend a lot of time thinking about how to not be canceled as an organization.
How much of your time do you spend trying to court donors?
Oh, not enough. If you ask, if you ask some of our friends,
how do you even do that? How do you find a donor?
Oh man,
how do you go donor hunting?
Tricks of the trade. So first off, we do have a small dollar donor base. We're really invested in that. I think it's important, and I've explored a ton in terms of fundraising models. I'm constantly thinking about it because at the end of the day, it's the lifeblood of an organization. But I do think that think tanks have a lot of trouble having a large small dollar donor base. For whatever reason, like Democratic small dollar donors are much more invested in like supporting like, you know, a Warren or a Bernie or a Kamala than they are in supporting a sort of think tank. And I think that is intuitive.
Think tank's not going to win an election as far as they're concerned. It's like it's not a team to root for.
Yeah. So what we've mostly found is that donors are really interested in the sort of work we do on narrative change and the work we do on supporting other organizations in terms of capacities that they might not necessarily have in-house.
Yeah.
Right. So we do almost all of our polling, and I would probably say like all with like very rare exceptions, like at no cost point of service to the organization who's asking us to run the polling. It's sort of a weird model, but like it sort of makes sense when you think about it. Like I don't have an accounting team to like harass you until you pay me. And it's not really worth my time to do so.
Yeah.
So we'll just do it.
You're accumulating goodwill.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll just do it. And if you like what we've done, we'll do more.
When you're actually trying to find a guy who will give you money, is it, well, I've heard this wealthy person gave money to this think tank and we're sort of similar to them, and so maybe he'd be interested in us? Is it word of mouth? Is there a secret list somewhere that you laugh nervously. He's not tugging his collar. I'm kidding. But this is, how do you do that?
Yeah, I go to, what is the Alex Jones thing where all the rich people meet up?
Oh, yeah. Bohemian Grove, right?
Yeah, I go to Bohemian Grove.
Yeah, just find them all hanging there.
We have a very close friend of the tank who I once asked, like, oh, what do we do to get like more donors more invested in data progress? And he said, you should fire yourself. And he was like being a meanie. but like, it should be clear, like anyone who thinks like we're like, you know, like chilling out with rich people, like I'm a socialist because I don't like hanging out with rich people. And I still am very bad at doing the like hanging out with rich people part of the stuff. So what we tend to basically have is like people who really like what Data for Progress does are like, you should give money to Sean. They really need it. And also like Sean will never ask you because he's too proud. No, but like, I mean, that's part of it. But like we have a sort of like core set of competencies that I think people mm-hmm. are interested in, and people like sort of want to support our ability mm-hmm. to, you know, pull on a lot of these progressive policies. And so we sort of like had folks who were like, hey, you know, like you should really give Data for Progress money to like do some pulling on criminal justice issues. And we've done some great pulling on criminal justice issues.
So is there sort of like an element of rich guys saying, we don't like you, but we like what you do?
I think that there's also been a shift. And like, to be clear, like one of the very good things about Data for Progress is like, we're like not expensive. Like we don't have to like pay for rent and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it means that like, we don't have to spend a ton of time raising money because we just like don't need that much of it.
Your cost per tweet is very low.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I like don't spend that much time, and I can be like kind of bad at it. And also because like there was like a quote I once said in BuzzFeed about like the Radiohead, and people like I think misunderstood it. What I meant was like people who
what was the quote?
I said like we're like Radiohead for donors. Like people know we're like good, but they don't know why.
Okay.
Because like I think that's my interpretation of Radiohead. What I mean by that is that I don't change what we're going to do because of rich people. And so if you like what we're doing, like support it, but like, you know, like we're not like, we don't really want support that has strings attached. And because we don't need that much money, we can like be at that level. And because the people who are interested in the work we're doing are really interested in the work we're doing, there's no worry about like sort of like, you know, intervening in the work that we're doing, or like us doing something and like them getting mad. Like, you know, Data for Progress is what it is. If you're interested in it, like, you know what you're getting into.
Do you ever have to put on a suit and tie though and like go do the presentation and like kind of pretend?
I don't have a suit. I don't have a suit. I recently testified in like the New York State Senate, and like the night before I like bought a sport coat. I remember I had a meeting like that, and the person was like, oh, do you have like a deck for me or something like that? And I was like, oh, I just thought we were like going to chill and like, you know, talk about Data for Progress. But yeah, like I'm like really bad at that type of thing, and I don't really like spending time doing it. I like, what really makes me happy is like, you know, like working to make the organization stronger and better, and, you know, building our reputation relationship with other organizations. I find all of that sort of like schmoozing stuff to like, it just like it to be entirely huge waste of time.
You said you do side gigs to support your What are some of the side gigs?
Well, I do the polling for Take Back the Courts.
Yeah.
Time to expand the court.
Yeah.
I should do a pitch. Court expansion is a great idea. I do their polling, work with them a little on the media.
So you do some of the stuff that you would ordinarily, with the Data for Progress ordinarily do, but you do it for other think tanks and not under your own brand.
Yeah, yeah. So like I am the director of polling at Take Back the Courts.
Yeah.
So Sean McAwee, who's director of polling at Take Back the Courts, and Sean McAwee, who is co-founder of Data for Progress, are different people. But you know, like
it's Clark Kent and Superman.
Right. Like the Take Back the Courts polling does not come out under the Data for Progress brand. And, you know, work with them in terms of like doing sort of like polling and research on the court. And I don't know how much you've like engaged with my writing, but you know, for about 5 years I've had like a little bit of some thoughts on the Supreme Court, and I've been
a few thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. I've been blessed to be able to like sort of put those into sort of specific practical points about the Supreme Court. Like I have a tracking poll on opinion about John Roberts, and I have a tracking poll on views of the court in terms of whether it's a political institution or a constitutional institution. And I work to change those, and it's very fun. And I advise the Demand Justice at the beginning on their court work as well.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You guys worked pretty hard on automatic voter registration in New York. Was that basically your first real legislative push?
AVR. Yeah. Yeah.
I know it's a little painful, but I want to talk
about...
We got
about, a binding press release, if that's...
You got, so that's... I want to talk about this because, you know, I think this is also a mystery to people. Is how do you actually try to push an idea out to a legislator? How do you work with politicians? I mean, like,
yeah,
where... Tell me about how you guys got involved in that issue and how you took it up as, like, where was the start of that?
So I live in New York. New York came very close to passing automatic voter registration, will do so next year in January. So automatic voter registration builds upon the National Voter Registration Act. So the National Voter Registration Act was passed in Bill Clinton's presidency, signed into law by Bill Clinton. And that requires public agencies such as DMVs, Medicaid offices, to offer an individual a chance to register to vote when they interact with those agencies. And since the NVRA, we have moved to a world in which the modal person is registered at a DMV rather than their board of elections. So all automatic voter registration does is to change whether that is an opt-in to an opt-out. There are two forms of this. One is you opt out at the point of service, which is the DMV or Medicaid office, which is what California has, Colorado used to have. And one is the model that Oregon has and Colorado now has, which is you opt out through a mailer after the transaction. I've been very interested in automatic voter registration for a long time. I did a lot of research on automatic voter registration at Demos. When I was at Demos, we published, I believe, the first study examining the demographics of who's registered to vote with automatic voter registration. And so once New York had a trifecta, was very interested in seeing that through. So we worked very closely with—
And trifecta means once the Democrats took over all the—
Yes, yeah. We used to have the Independent Democratic Conference.
We had a screwed up situation in New York, is basically where Republicans held control over a chamber, even though technically Democrats had the majority. But
yes.
So once we got rid of that, this was an opportunity to try and push through a reform that would probably mean more New Yorkers registered.
Yeah, many
to vote.
More registered New Yorkers. And we worked very closely with Senator Gianaris, and he was a very strong advocate. And I still believe, like, we will.
But was this something where the politicians brought it to you and said, we need help with this, or you brought it to the politicians?
So I met with Senator Gianaris shortly after Democrats took the state Senate. And I think to the extent that we could take any credit for anything, it was really working to impress upon the senator, like, the importance of automatic voter registration as a priority. And I think that it's definitely true that he was much more engaged and saw the issue much more centrally to his agenda because of the work of, you know, Data for Progress, which is under the organization AVR now, for sure. And we met with, like, a lot of legislators. We walked them through a lot of concerns.
How did you even get that meeting? How do you get into the office in the first place?
Yeah, this is, like, sort of like a weird secret about, like, everything we do, which is, like, how am I in the room with a lot of people?
How the hell did you get there?
I don't really know. It's mostly been, like, I sort of just asked.
did you send an email? Yeah, I mean, like, what was the...
Yeah, so I was doing work on the No IDC coalition during that time. And so I had, like, had a conversation with the person who was working with Mike at the state DSCC, which works to ensure a Democratic state Senate majority in New York. And I was just, like, mentioning it. I was like, hey, by the way, like, Mike should come by the happy hour sometime. Like, I think you'd have a good time.
And that's Gianaris. Mike.
And then Mike came by the happy hour.
This is the socialist happy hour, as it's been dubbed, the weekly happy hour you host in New York.
Yeah, like, you'd be quite surprised at, like, how many politicians you can hang out with. Or you're just like, hey, like, you want to chill? I don't know. Like,
so you invited the state senator to the happy hour. he showed up, and so you got to know him that way.
Yeah, we just chilled.
That worked. And so once Democrats took over, you were able to get a meeting to talk about AVR.
Yeah. Is that like a big thing, like getting a meeting?
I don't know. I have no idea how I would do it. So this is the mystery, right? Maybe there's less mystery to it than someone typically thinks.
Yeah, I think there's like less mystery to a lot of the stuff. Like, you know, one of the things that we found is like, you know, there's like a sort of newfangled style of like progressive data organization that's like, we're going to get VC money and then blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I just find that, you know, I'm like a very like socialist critique of this type of stuff where it's like, I think money like really makes a lot of this stuff like a lot harder to do. You know, it like, it makes all these relationships much more strained. And so that's why when we're working with like, you know, grassroots partners, we're just like, yeah, don't worry about that. Like, just worry about like what you need and we'll get that to you.
So when you're actually working on that campaign, were you polling it? Were you buttonholing other politicians and talking to them about it? What were you doing exactly?
Oh, dude, I was really a jackass of all trades on that, you know?
Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, seriously, like, we did do polling on it. We did research on sort of the impacts of AVR. I, like, held a press conference with Scott Stringer, who's our comptroller at the city council building. I spoke at a rally for AVR. Any aspect of AVR, I hopped into. I testified on the state Senate. I worked with partners to coordinate in terms of like getting calls to the state senators, getting calls to the assembly members, had a ton of meetings with different state senators and assembly members, you know, worked with different organizations, built up coalitions. Like we really did. You know, like we tried to be involved in every aspect of the fight that it made sense for us to be involved in.
Is that the sort of thing think tanks ordinarily do? Or is that something, I mean, running an actual campaign for a policy or?
I wouldn't say we fully ran the campaign.
Or helping to run a campaign like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would say AVR Now was a coalition partner. Yeah, that's pretty, I think it's like pretty standard. It tends to be something like a little bit bigger organizations do.
So is it like everyone gets on a phone call and said, here are all the different groups, there's a conference call and they say, Data for Progress, here's what we need you to do. Or like, how do you figure out your role in that?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like there were definitely like big meetings with like lots of different organizations and coalitions within New York. And there were very regular check-ins in terms of what we were going on. And like, there were, you know, policy disagreements within progressive groups that we worked to settle, which was, you know, definitely a part of it. And I think we all ended up coming in together on stuff in the end. But yeah, I mean, like it was a pretty standard legislative advocacy project. And like, you know, we released several reports. You know, we had a couple of letters that we circulated to the different legislators. So we had a letter on AVR Now that was sort of co-anchored by AVR Now that was on AVR and racial justice. And obviously to do that, we ended up forming coalitions with like a lot of racial justice organizations like Demos to push for AVR. So we would have like calls to make sure everyone's like comfortable with this letter and who wants to sign on to the letter and like which local individuals want to sign on to the letter. Like, yeah.
So there's a lot of coordination and then everyone goes off and does their part of it.
Yeah. And I mean, we'd have calls and to check in on like, you know, which days do we want to send the most calls and like, how do we send tweets to the legislators? Like, how do we apply as much pressure as possible? And I think that's one of the biggest lessons that's come from me in terms of running this organization and like the sort of view on the institutions is like, there are so many things that you have to do that like no one really ever trains you on as part of being a leftist. Like I think leftists spend a lot of time thinking about like, how is Trotskyism different from Leninism? And it's like, it doesn't really tell you much when you're trying to pass AVR. But you know, like I'm not saying that's not useful to do. I'm saying that like there tends to be a lot of sort of emotional intelligence and sort of situational intelligence that you really have to develop to build the sort of coalitions that it takes to actually like pass into law things.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this bill in the end didn't pass.
Well, it did pass the Senate.
Passed the Senate, and then there was sort of a last minute controversy about how it was written that they put it off until next session, essentially.
Yeah, the controversy was basically there was sort of some language in the legislation that was unclear as to what it intended to do with regards to undocumented folks who go to the DMV. And this is something that could be fixed in chapter amendments. If you know anything about the legislative process, like tons of stuff gets fixed in chapter amendments after the fact. But what happened is there's a Republican woman who is on, I believe, Long Island. She's the one challenging Max Rose.
Yeah.
Who sort of used this as a chance to like sort of demagogue and raise her profile.
Yeah.
And sort of like, oh, look at this thing that they're going to pass.
They're going to try and register.
With the intent to,
undocumented immigrants. They're going to try and register them to vote.
And of course, everyone knew the intent was like in chapter amendments, this will all get banged out. But given the sort of like, you know, the state of things, there was a decision to, instead of doing it in chapter amendments, to instead do it in January of 2019.
Which, I mean, you can sort of understand the political logic of that. You don't want to give someone the firepower to say you voted to let, you know, undocumented immigrants register. But, I mean, how long had you worked on that push for, on that legislative push for? How long had this campaign been going on?
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, interest in like automatic voter registration in New York has been something that I've been interested in for as long as I've lived in New York and supported automatic voter registration. But, you know, laying the groundwork probably started like 5 or 6 months before we took the state Senate. And like there, I don't want to like minimize in any way like the fact that there's like a Let New York Vote Coalition and stuff like that. Like there, the Let New York Vote Coalition is focused on a broad suite of electoral reforms, whereas AVR Now is obviously centered on one particular. But yeah, I mean, there was several months, and I will say, like, we still do work on AVR. We're doing a ton of work studying AVR, and a lot of that's actually involved sort of basically loaning out access to our data resources to academics. Quite often, I'll have better access to data resources than academics, so we're able to, like, sort of give them access to that to run the research they want to do on AVR. And we'll have some – there will actually be papers on AVR presented at APSA, the American Political Science Association conference at the end of this month that are possible because of the Data for Progress. So I'm really excited about that.
I mean, is there a, to put it bluntly, that would suck when it didn't pass that, right? Like that was, that couldn't have been fun.
Oh, I said at the time it was the worst day of my life. Yeah, it's, I like called a friend that time. It was like, I'm just going to quit politics entirely. Like,
really?
Yeah.
Just because it seemed like it's something that should pass and it just somehow like faded, conspired or.
It was hard because I sort of found out a lot because like when you're in the thick of it, it's like very hard to often know what's going on. Like information travels very quickly. And I had really thought it was like a failure of me. And I think like a lot of people who like don't like me for many reasons. On Twitter, like decided it was a failure of me and sort of like stepping back and sort of understanding like what specifically went wrong and how we can fix it. And I mean, like New York will have AVR. But yeah, I mean, it's the legislative process is an incredibly fickle one.
I want to come back to that happy hour, the socialist happy hour. I don't know if that, did you call it that or originally or what is, how did, was that Jonathan
know.
Chait who called it
did,
that?
He got really mad at it. I mean, like.
Is that so? It seems to me like
happy hour is like a really interesting thing.
Yeah. Well, so it seems like that also serves like a professional need and like a sort of an organizing niche for you, right? It's not just like a get together.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
like, what is the point of the happy hour?
Yeah. The point of it is like this is like genuinely true. This is a fun thing. I was in like libertarian circles in DC and right, and like it definitely like I don't know if you know this, but like Cato Institute's like fucking loaded. And so they have like little happy hours and stuff. And it's like really useful because like if you're a libertarian, you can hang out at that. And when I came to New York, like there are sort of those, but it's like book launches and stuff. And like, I don't know, books are like kind of boring to me. And I don't like to hear like lectures. And so I was like, well, what is a way that people could hang out that's like not a book launch and a lecture? And like, you know, if you go to like all the progressive stuff, it's like you have to listen through like some city council member talk for like 20 minutes. And I don't like that. That stuff pours the shit on me. So I was like, OK, well, I'll start this happy hour that people can come to. And I was always very, very like open to people coming. I don't like want Republicans and conservatives to come because like, fuck that. But if you like believe in progressive values, it doesn't matter to me if you are like sort of a more establishment Democrat or the most DSA member of DSA member, because I wanted to have a place where people could like talk through this stuff, because I saw like so much of the fights on Twitter and it's just like, y'all are talking past each other and you're being more of an asshole than you would be. Like, actually sit across each other at a happy hour or something, talk at happy hour, and like maybe you'll sort of get an understanding of this, because there is this sense to me in politics that like a lot of people within the progressive movement very broadly, right, have these really bad faith thoughts about the way that these other people within the movement are approaching the world. And if we can sort of like get to more of an understanding of how people are coming to that, I'm not saying we can't have disagreements. I'm fine with disagreements. A lot of my life is negotiating disagreements. But what I don't think is that, I don't think that like right now in a lot of instances, we're actually finding the places that people have disagreements and working through those. We're really talking past each other and talking past characters. And so I think the happy hour is still a place where like we can have like some of those discussions.
To be clear, this is a weekly thing you've been throwing for how long now?
I grew up in like religious circles, and there's like a Bible verse, thou shalt not forsake the gathering thyself together. And I have some friends who do like a happy hour that's like sort of modeled after mine, but like less famous people come by. I'm just fucking with them. But like they do it like really iteratively, and it's like really hard to plan around. Whereas my happy hour, like, you know, like I don't really take vacations on account of, I don't really have any way to take a vacation on account of, I don't like have vacation days and stuff. So I don't do that. So I only miss like one or two happy hours like a year. And so it's every Thursday. So, you know, Thursday, if you're near the happy hour, you can stop by. And I really think that's a core principle of it, is like really doing that weekly thing. I think that's something that their church has done well. I actually like was working back on this. It has now been like more than 4 years.
I just like that the socialist happy hour is actually an idea borrowed from like standard wonky DC think tankery. That like
and the church.
And the church. that's where that came from. This is like, it makes sense. It's like an organizing tactic. People have been getting together and talking ideas while getting drunk on the left for centuries now.
So. Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it, if you like actually look at like the broad Sean McAwee theory of American politics, like much of it is like trying to convince the left to adopt the tactics that the Koch brothers have used, but for good things.
In this case, getting drunk is one important tactic. All right, man. Thank you for coming on.
Have a great one.
You too.
And that is it for this week's episode of Working. As always, I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, please leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. If you have questions, comments, thoughts, send them to me. It's working@slate.com. Again, that is working@slate.com. The show is produced by Jessamine Molly. A special thank you to Justin D. Wright for the ad music. I'm your host, Jordan Weissman. Please catch us next week.